When I was 20, I had the occasion to hitchhike through Denmark a few times, and that may be just incidental where it was, but there were a couple of memorable experiences hitchhiking in Denmark. One of them, someone was asking me what I was interested in, and I gave a long list of things like Zen and Sufism and Aikido and Gestalt, and you know, I just went through all this kind of stuff that was in my culture, like just kind of just matter of fact say, yeah, this and that and this and that, you know. At some point the driver turned to me and said, "You have a lot of desires." And that was kind of a little bit of a wake up. How easy it is to have desires. How easy it is to be, you know, for your car to run on the fuel of desires, just going, going, going. So that was one. The other one was, I was hitchhiking and it got to be night. So someone dropped me off at the edge of some town, some little town or town. And so what do I do now? You know, I had a sleeping bag with me, so where I was dropped off, there was a stone wall. On the other side was lawn and some trees and bushes. And oh, there's a park. So I jumped over the fence, over the stone wall, and found myself under kind of a little tree, bush kind of thing, where I rolled up my sleeping bag and slept contentedly for the night until it got light in the morning, to discover that I was sleeping on top of a grave. That I'd gone to a cemetery. And so my interest in sleeping on top of that grave changed very quickly. I was very content and felt safe and happy there. But once I knew it, I was sleeping on, you know, someone's property, someone's under there, I guess. I could see my interest and my delight in where I'd found to sleep quickly changed, and I packed up and continued on my trip. So the first story was a story about desires and how for some of us it's very easy to have desires and they just roll along and keep things fueling things. And the other is how we could find delightful and happy something that is seeing it in a different angle, we're no longer interested, disinterested, and maybe even something stronger. There's a similar kind of cemetery story. The founder of Korean Zen was in a shipwreck and made his way to shore and also night, and found a little cave apparently to go into, and it was really dark and was really thirsty, and discovered there was a bowl inside the cave that had some water in it because it was raining or something, and so he drank the water and slept, and then he woke up in the morning and he too was in some kind of grave and crypt or something. And the bowl he drank out of was the top of someone's skull. And that awoke something in him. I think that's like his enlightenment story or something. So, wow. And I don't know exactly how it worked for him, but I could imagine also this changing perspective. Oh, it's different than I thought. And, you know, boy, I had this worldview created about what this was, and then I saw what was actually quite different. It's a cemetery, it's a grave I'm sleeping on. Oh, it's not a bowl, it's a top of a skull. And this kind of waking up from perceptions and dreams and ideas of what we're living in is part of this process of practice. And that can operate when we start kind of waking up to these three characteristics, these three insights. The one that talked about yesterday of not self. I think that it's fair that a few of you occasionally are deeply rooted in self and self-concern. It might be accidental, but I think it does happen occasionally. And there are people out in the world for whom it's a big deal. And they organize their life around who they want to be, who they think they are, who they've been told they are. And there's a lot of effort and energy that goes into building up, creating, defending, supporting, living some concept, idea of self that we have, might have. And to have an insight into this not-self in a deep way is to loosen up the grip of that, or the interest in it, or to break up the allure and the promise that that seems to come along with, and to see that that doesn't work. And that can be disorienting. When everything, our whole life, has been built up around, our parents helped build the sense of self, you know, our school system did it, and everything built it up. And then to have a sense of the ouch of things, to have a sense of dukkha, and to realize that a lot of the ways we operate maybe have ouches in them more than we realized. It's easy to, in the projection of ideas and promise and what we're going to get out of it, to do things, pursue desires, engage in desires and aversions that have a lot of ouch in them. Sometimes the intensity of the self-identity that we have, the importance of maintaining it, proving it, asserting it, overrides the sense of discomfort that goes into doing so. We don't even see how uncomfortable, because it's the religion of self is so strong that that it just overrides noticing, like, wow, I'm pretty uncomfortable here, pursuing all this, doing all this. And sometimes, you know, the intensity of desire, even for pleasure, is painful. The pursuit or the engagement in hatred and anger, the pursuit of it is, or the engagement in living from that place, and you start seeing this hurts. And so it becomes less interesting, less and less interesting. But what's to replace it? If the fuel of our life is desire or aversion, desire, anger, greed and hatred, it kind of leaves us empty and blank and uninspired to not have them. Some people feel lost without them. They've never learned any other way of being. They think of this Buddhism as a kind of a nihilism. And this not-self thing, too, it can seem like a nihilism. It's kind of like a nihilism, like I'm supposed to be destroyed here, this Buddhist practice, and I'm not supposed to exist, and who am I if I'm not me? Who am I if I'm not these things I thought I was? It's really challenging. I mean, I think the representation for me of the challenge, I don't know if it's exactly this way, but I've heard a number of times about people who are so invested in their profession that soon after they stopped the profession, retired, they died, they had a heart attack or something, because the transition to not being that person was so difficult. You know, to be, to have a purpose, a meaning, to have approval and praise and status and so many things, that maybe sense of safety even came from it. And so to not have it is so disorienting for some people. So here in this practice too, it can be very disorienting to go through these three characteristics. And then on top of, you know, this questioning this whole enterprise of self and the religion of self that you know, the cult of self, which seems to exist in our society. And to question the role that desires and aversions have in our life. I mean, that's bad enough. And then we're supposed to see also that everything is changing all the time. I mean, now they're unstable, and you know, what am I supposed to rely on? Where do I stand? What do I do? And for some people who live very unstable lives and grew up in war zones and never have a home, and this experience in meditation even of a change and permanence and kind of feeling and experiencing how profound and deep it is quite upsetting, quite difficult. So all these together, for some people, it's really a challenge because it's a whole new perspective. You can't just roll up your sleeping bag and, you know, get out of the cemetery. And hope for another ride out of town. And so this is one of the reasons why I emphasized at the beginning of the retreat the importance of stability and well-being and confidence. That these are actually very important foundations. They're not meant to be directly connected to conceits of self, not directly connected to the pursuit of ordinary desires and aversions, and not directly connected to immediately having some insight into how everything changes, but rather to cultivate a context, a foundation for the insights, so that they can really work for us, they can really support us and free us and liberate us without getting too discouraged, too disillusioned from what happens as we go through it. And so, we went through now these three important aspects of this mindfulness practice: knowing, sensing, and calming, relaxing. And then these three foundations for the practice: stability, well-being, and confidence. And then these three, what's called the three characteristics, these three insights into inconstancy, change, into ouch, and into not self. And so now we're into the next three. And the English way of usually discussing these is the names is disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation. And these are to kind of really be connected or see these three characteristics deeply and well, which, you know, all these things come and go. You're not necessarily supposed to be exactly here in your practice, but following the sequence of the talks, when these three characteristics become strong and clear, then there's These are what can kind of follow from that. And the first is called disenchantment. The second is a dispassion. And so I was going to do one talk on each, but because I missed two talks with being away, I'll put these two together for today. And I think they work well together. So the word nibbida, if you play the etymology game, which some Buddhist teachers seem to like to do, it's an ancient tradition of doing so. In the ancient India, the word comes to the B, it's N-I-B-B-I-D-A, and the double B there is what happens in compound words to a V. A V becomes a B. And you kind of see it because, you know, anyway. Veda part of it, the Veda, then the V-I-D part of it, that originally, the same word as Veda, the Vedas, the knowledges, Vidya, to know or knowledge. But Veda by itself can also mean religious inspiration. And so this is not being inspired, disinspired. This disinspiration that can come. I like the English word disenchantment because it means that you were under the spell of something. So the spell gets broken. Disinterest, or disinspired, you know, like what's wrong with being inspired? Well, that's what's wrong with being inspired if you're inspired by the wrong thing. And that's what we discover, that we're kind of being fueled by the inspiration. We're inspired by winning the lottery ticket. And there's big news in the paper when they have big lottery prizes. So it must be exciting for people that that's in the news. People must be enchanted. Wow. So to be disenchanted, disinspired, I don't find it inspiring whatsoever to win the lottery ticket. So the inspiration to fade away, or the enchantment, the spell wonder to fade away. And sometimes this word is understood quite powerfully as in colloquial English, becoming sick and tired of something. The deep weariness, enough already. Some people discover this around their thinking. They realize, you know, how much they've been thinking, and the cost of it, and the repetition of it, and the silliness of it, and the stress of it. And some people at some point feel so weary. It's incessant thinking. Give me a break. Enough already. I'm sick and tired of thinking about lottery tickets or whatever it is you think about. I've heard Buddhist teachers describe this as a form of being sick and tired of it all or something, as a form of wisdom. Oh, you're getting wise now that you realize that lottery tickets are not going to make you happy. That you're sick and tired of every week going and putting your money down. So, you know, it's whatever it is, you fill in the blank. But in this wonderful teachings of the Buddha, it's kind of meant to, I'm still inspired by reading them and seeing them. I haven't been disinspired yet, though. it's said by some teachers that there was one saying is, if it's not boring, it's not Buddhism. And then some teachers say, you know, that you know, at some point you're actually supposed to get bored with it, supposed to get disillusioned with Buddhism, even Buddhism. Can you believe it? But you're not supposed to stop practicing. I think it can be healthy to be disillusioned, because there's all this enchantment and illusions and ideas about how, you know, what Buddhism is going to do for us, and how it's a great world religion, and everyone will live happily ever after, and it's just fulfillment of all the fairy tales. And if that's the case, we want you to be disillusioned. Or the practice will disillusion you sooner or later. You come down to earth and realize, wait a minute, this just leaves me being myself as a human. Wait a minute, that's not what I signed up for. Just myself as a human with all these odd things that I do and feel, and yep. Sooner or later, it's good to be disillusioned in Buddhism, so that you turn the attention around and start doing the work for yourself. So this disillusionment. Oh, so what I want to say about what inspires me about the Buddha is that, because I'm not completely disillusioned yet, is when you look at carefully at his teachings on these kind of things like this disenchantment and dispassion, I'll talk about in a few minutes. It's seldom about the world or things out there. He, over and over again, what he's talking about is becoming disenchanted with clinging, disenchanted with craving, disenchanted with hatred, disenchanted with these painful movements of the mind and the heart that we have. It's not a statement about the world. It's a statement about how we relate to the world, how we're relating. That's the heart of it. And you don't always get that. We don't always get that feeling from Buddhist teachings, where it seems like sometimes it seems to be about, you know, you're supposed to be disillusioned in the world, but it's really the craving. So it's not what disillusioned with lottery tickets. It's disillusioned with my craving for them and what it's all going to do. That's the heart of it. So at some point we start seeing, and this is where the importance of seeing, knowing, feeling, all these things, and relaxing kind of mature and develop in us. We start seeing clearly what doesn't work, what's driving us and what's moving us, and this no longer works. This is not helpful, it's not healthy, it's painful, it's maybe it works a little bit, then it comes back and bites me. I have a desire, and the world provides you with the desire, and wow. But if you're, you know, that's set up sometimes for later crashing or being disappointed. Or so at some point, beginning, you know, to develop this disenchantment that's in, no longer inspired, disillusionment that's in. And then what comes in the wake of that is then begins a process where those attachments begin to fade away. And the wonderful thing in Patpali is that the word for dispassion and fading away are the same word. In fact, I think what it's, the word started off as being fading away of the dye, you know, dye clothes a certain color. The word viraga is the fading of the raga, of the dye. And then the dye, I think, was used as a metaphor for lust, for passion, for the strong urges of emotions and desires people have. And so then viraga became something like something close to, related to, the English word dispassion. But this idea of fading away is very important, because there's plenty of people who come to Buddhism, and somehow the way it's gotten across to them is that Buddhism, that there's a, they've taken in the Big Bang theory of enlightenment. That if I just huff and puff enough, then boom, you know, I'll see what I need to see. I'll like release what has to be released. You know, something magical will change, and I'll be happy ever after, and all my problems are gone, and I get to wear the enlightenment badge or the medal or something. But the I think more mature understanding of practice, I think a more mature approach to understanding what practice is about, is not to be chasing after some Big Bang experience, but value and appreciate the slow, steady process of fading away, the slow, steady process of whittling away at attachments and clingings and cravings and the preoccupations, the conceits. And because it's a slow process, to be caring for yourself, to be compassionate, to not be, not to have more greed, hatred on top of what greed, hatred you already have, but to enter into it in a way that creates the right context, the right frame of reference, the right state of mind that allows these things to fade away, allows us to not participate, not feed the fire, not add more kindling to the fire of greed and hatred, but to you know, let the fire begin to die out. And so this fading away it takes time, it takes practice. And so the idea of being in it for the long haul, however long it takes, because this is worthwhile. This is a meaningful, purposeful, valuable way of living a life, because the other way doesn't work. The other way just contributes to this world at large, contributes more of the same delusion and conceits and hatreds and values that don't really bring out the best in us, maybe. And so to then be willing to do the work for this fading away, and to find out what is it that supports it. And here's where we come back to these three foundations I talked about: stability, well-being, and confidence. And the well-being part includes things like brahmaviharas, having kindness, having compassion, having love. To cultivate these, not in the old system, you know, of conceit, maybe I'm going to be the most loving person at the retreat and everyone will see me as being this most loving person, and I have to make sure I stand in the front of the line so that everyone can recognize how loving I am and how free of conceit I've become. You know, so there is an old way of doing it in all this practice, but to find what's the new way. What's a way to do it that's open-handed, open-hearted, open-minded? How to love without conceit? How to love without expectation? How to love, care, without needing anything to be returned? Doing it because it's good for our hearts. It supports us. It supports, it creates the context that allows the relaxing, the thawing, the fading away of the ways that we have attachments. And again, the way the Buddha talks about this fading away process, this dispassion process, he talks about it in terms of pride, conceit, attachments, greed, and hatred. So and if you really understand the ouch of those, you understand how valuable it is to let those fade away and go away. The fading away also means that it's never going to be either or. It's not going to be like they're either on or they're not on, these things. And so it means you've got to put up with having a degree of conceit and attachments and greed and hatred as part of who you are, and be patient with it. Be wise about it and not cause harm with it as you go through. Not judge yourself wrong because you have it. But rather, if you need to judge yourself well because you're on a path of letting it fade away. You're a path of diminishing it, path of harm reduction to freedom. So then, and so the inspiration, the move, the inspiration comes back. This deep disillusionment happens that can be replaced by an inspiration in what this work is. This work is to somehow or other see the diminishment, the lessening. The Buddha used this kind of the idea of the thinning away. He talked about a big marine rope, I guess a rope that holds a boat. That is probably out of hemp or something, natural product back in his time. And that if you left it in the sun, the sun would slowly disintegrate it. But you wouldn't know exactly when it would finally break the last thread. But it would just disintegrate, and eventually... Or the example of someone who's a wood chopper, I guess, with an axe. And I guess somehow the axe handle is getting worn away by all the chopping. And you don't quite know when it'll finally break. So this idea of thinning, wearing away. We don't know how long it's going to take, but we have to do our work and do it. Remember Sylvia Borstein, who's a Spirit Rock teacher, saying that she heard this story about the thinning away and using the axe, and just you don't know how many times you have to hit it so that before it finally breaks. And it so inspired her. She said, and in practice, she said, I don't know how long I have to do this, but now I just got to do it. And she threw herself into the practice, one step at a time, and with this idea fading away. So we have these two concepts of disenchantment and dispassion, where passion is this intense, what is it, the raga, that intense drive for desires, lust, and hatred, and anger, and aversion, and conceit, these strong things that we have in us. And so we call it dispassion in English, more often than not. And plenty of English-speaking people are troubled by this word dispassion. I think maybe more in California than a lot of other places. You're having a passion for life. It's like a zest for life. It's like, it's kind of like you're supposed to in California, in some circles. So passion is a good thing, even though the Latin word means suffering. And so if you go look at how this word is used in ancient India, viraga, it From what I understand of people talk to people, Indians, and it's a word that's very popular, used in the religions of India down to this day, not just part of the ancient Buddhist language, teachings. And it's held up in high esteem. It's like an inspiring word. It's a heartwarming word. It's a, it's just like there's a big yes to this word, like viraga. And in a way that maybe in a few hundred years, maybe dispassion will have that meaning in the West if we really live up to its full Buddhist potential. But I think that the way viraga, the associations people have in India with viraga, are similar to what in some people in the culture here in the United States would have for the word freedom. Freedom is like, is for some people, is as heartwarming as apple pie, I suppose. And it's a meaningful word. We use it a lot in our language and so sometimes I think maybe this word viraga should be translated or could be translated as freedom. It's the freedom from conceit and pride and attachments, cravings, greeds and hatred. What a great thing to be free of those. In the teachings of the Buddha, these things that we're being free of are clearly seen to be sources of suffering. Sources for suffering and suffering themselves in and of themselves. So sooner or later when we do this practice, we see that. We see that for ourselves. We see that something that we're doing inside of us, we've reached a little, maybe it worked for a while, but at some point we see it doesn't work anymore. This doesn't work to do this anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. I've had enough of it. I'm sick and tired of it. I'm no longer inspired by it. There has to be a better way. And then perhaps the inspiration can, at some point you go through this disillusionment phase where nothing seems to have any meaning for a while, perhaps, or why even practice anymore? I mean, like everything just seems like pointless in the wake of the three characteristics. But then at some point, the inspiration comes back when we realize that what's at the heart of all this is this fading away, this wearing away, this diminishment of fading away and thinning out and settling in and letting go and seeing clearly and making room for things and holding things in kindness and care and letting kind of these powerful forces inside begin to settle. That which is restless in us goes towards rest. That which is agitated in us goes towards peace. That which is constricted in us goes to being open. This movement that is gradual, slow, and steady, that goes on and on. And how do we do that? It's a remarkable thing about this practice is that it's kind of the same practice, whether you're a beginner or a middle person or an experienced practitioner. It's kind of all the same. You know your experience, sense your experience, feel it really. Sometimes settle back and just observe it and see it. Remember from time to time to relax. to quiet yourself. And then do it again, and again, and again. Then all the permutations, all the ups and downs, all the changing nature of it all, it's kind of like the repetition of that over and over again. And then I'll just end with a kind of an appendix at these three forms of attention that we've emphasized here. Knowing, feeling, sensing, and seeing come into play differently for each of the three characteristics. Seeing is stepping back and seeing the process of change, the inconstancy. It's something you kind of the mind's eye can see. It's the nature of our perceptions, that how we perceive, that we see the inconstancy. The dukkha that we can, and the ajna belongs a lot more to the world of feeling. And the not-self, it belongs more to the world of knowing, because you don't actually see not-self. You can't feel not-self, but you can know it. It's a kind of a cognitive move for the mind. That doesn't diminish its importance, that it's cognitive, that it's a knowing, but it is a seeing. It's not a seeing, it's a knowing, a very meaningful knowing of something that's absence. It can be actually quite powerful to know this absence. So, as some of you maybe, these three characteristics might stand in highlight sometimes, it might be interesting to appreciate the shifts that go on with what forms of attention are most active, most alive as you're aware of them. Is it more seeing with the mind's eye? Is it more feeling? Is it more knowing? And if it's, you know, it can be any old way. I mean, it doesn't have to be that exactly lined up the way I said, but I offer this to add to the richness of what we're exploring and the fullness of kind of getting to know it more and the territory that we're walking in. Be thoroughly disinterested in clinging and thoroughly interested in non-clinging. Thank you.